Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
WGN, I'm John Landecker at 836. That's Gershwin's American in Paris, which has a direct relationship to our guest, Howard Reich, former jazz and classical music critic for the Tribune. Good evening, Howard. Welcome.
So glad to be here. Thank you, and thank you for playing the absolutely perfect opening music.
Thank you for having the time to come on with us tonight. Now, the only reason that you're a former critic is because you took a buyout. And I get that.
Right.
I get that. There's a lot of that going around. And the Tribune, financially, you know, you got to deal with what you got to deal with. And you will be missed as far as that particular publication is concerned. But there are so many other ways to do what you do today.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The article that appeared January 11th was Farewell to Readers. I've spent 4-plus decades in the company of cultural giants talking about jazz and classical music. And the list of people that you have quoted and what they have said to you is mind-boggling. Frank Sinatra, Red Skelton, I'm not going to go through all of them, B.B. King, Ray Charles, Wynton Marsalis, Van Cliburn. Oh, yep. My God, Van Cliburn. I haven't thought about Van Cliburn in decades. When did you talk to Van Cliburn?
It was, I first met him in 1989 in Fort Worth, Texas. And we struck up a friendship, a dialogue, yeah. And that was my first book, was the biography of Van Cliburn, which was published in 1993.
Well, there's a lot of things that I want to get to, and I guess, first of all, let's talk for a second about how this American in Paris affected you when you were a kid watching TV in Skokie, and you were the son of Holocaust survivors, and that fact in itself sort of, how do I put this, dominates the conversation around you. I think you sort of described it as a noise, the din. It just never, ever stopped because of the post-traumatic stress disorder, the experience that these people went through, and they just can't stop talking about it. And as a youngster, tell us how this music got you out of that, gave you a way out.
So it's true. Both my parents are Holocaust survivors, and my aunts and uncles are Holocaust survivors. So this was the wallpaper, the backdrop of my life. And though they didn't speak to me about this subject, they spoke to each other about it all the time. And one night in our little Skokie house, I went downstairs, I turned on the TV, and this movie comes on, An American in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And it has music by George Gershwin, choreography and dancing and singing by Gene Kelly, Piano Virtuosity by Oscar Levin. It just hit me like a hurricane. This was it. This is what would remove me from the dissonance and the trauma of my family's house. And I thought, this is what I've got to do with my life, music. And the next day, I went up to my parents and I said, I've got to have piano lessons. And that became my entire life and career from that point forward.
And also, just to note that Gershwin himself is of a Jewish heritage and an immigrant, and that's got to be reflected in the music. And maybe there was some sort of connection that you made because of that with what was going on.
Absolutely. It was like, I think it's a subliminal connection.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Right, subliminal.
Yeah, I didn't even know it, but here is this young man, Gershwin, who's the son of Russian Jewish immigrants.
Right.
Who creates this music that's more American than any other music by incorporating jazz, and black music, and Jewish music. And that is what hit me, because it spoke to me, because Gershwin's music told me about my family's story in a way.
Well, I can relate to on a certain level. My father escaped. It was Jewish and escaped the Nazis before things got really, really bad. Very fortunate in the sense that he was a German Jew and did not, or any of my family on his side, suffer any of the Holocaust consequences. Mm-hmm. But certainly he spoke of it on occasion. And it was the reason he was in the United States. So I relate on a certain level, but not to the degree that you must have gone through as a young child. I've known Holocaust survivors personally. They all seem to have been permanently affected on some level. After all these years, and I can just imagine how the music just sort of freed you from this. And, you know, I think music itself, to even people who haven't had the horror of family members as Holocaust survivors, can provide some sort of emotional outlet or relief from the troubles in their life.
Absolutely. Music takes us to another place.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what kind of music you're listening to. Jazz, classical, rock, I don't care. Whatever it is that that moves you, it takes you out of your current trouble. As long as the music is playing and you're thinking about it. And that's I think, one of the universal appeals of music.
And so you hear this music, you get a piano, and then eventually you end up as a critic for the Tribune. How did all of that happen? Well, how was the transition from being in Skokie, there watching the television in American in Paris, and then your byline in the Tribune as a jazz and classical music critic?
Well, so what I did was I auditioned for the School of Music at Northwestern. I got in, and I immersed myself in music to a greater depth than I ever had. But after 4 years of that, I realized I cannot spend my life in a practice room, which is what you have to do, 8 hours a day practicing that piano. I wanted to be out there, see what's happening in the world. And then a little light bulb went off in my mind. Write about music. You're a natural writer. You've studied music. Write about it. And within months of me having that epiphany, I find myself freelancing for the Chicago Daily News, then the Chicago Tribune, and then I was hired. And suddenly, I'm a critic at the Chicago Tribune, and anyone in the world whom I want to interview is available to me. And all those heroes of mine are those you saw quoted in my farewell piece of a couple of weeks ago in the Tribune.
Right. There's also a great piece that was written by Mark Caro about you, which I want to get to.
Yeah.
And when I say a cross-section of the most amazing individuals, you're not that old, quite frankly. And we're talking about...
I'm 66.
That's nothing. Trust me, that's nothing. We're talking about... Kirk Douglas, Ginger Rogers, Lena Horne, Richard Lewis, you know, Richard Lewis, that Richard, the comedian, John Gielgud, holy criminy. I mean, wow, these are just some of the major icons ever. I mean, I felt lucky to talk to Dennis DeYoung, you know, I mean, it's just like.
I have talked to him, too. So the thing is, I think the people I saw on TV in these movies and in the big movie screen became my heroes.
Yeah.
And by virtue of being a critic, I could make contact with them. And so these golden age stars, such as Lena Horne and Kirk Douglas, were still alive. They're toward the end of their careers.
Yes.
When I was at the beginning of mine. And so therefore, I could still make contact with them while they were here. I'll give you one more example. To me, the greatest concert pianist of all time was Arthur Rubinstein.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in 1887. It's now 2021, and I heard his last concert in Chicago. I have a contact with a person who was born in 1887. That's
amazing.
The privilege of this position I've had at the Tribune.
Well, obviously, too, not just your writing had to be respected by all of these people for them to consent to talk to you. You obviously were not just some hack classical jazz critic, they had to appreciate your insight and your input from what you had written to consent to the interviews. And reading these quotes, they were very open about a lot of different things. And that just doesn't happen.
They were so candid. To me, whenever I speak to students, I tell them, when you interview someone, it comes down to one word, trust.
Yeah.
If that person trusts you, then they will speak. And if they don't, you've got nothing. And I've always tried to establish trust with these people, but I think they sense the admiration that I have for them and my hope to crystallize their achievements through my words. And that's what I've been able to do at the Tribune for 43 years.
Mark Carroll wrote an article January 14th, the title of which, Chicago music critic Howard Reich avoided writing about his family and the Holocaust until it became his calling. And we'll get into that when we come back on 720 WGN. WGN, I'm John Landecker with Howard Reich, former classical and jazz critic for the Chicago Tribune, and that's another cut from the Gershwin American in Paris Rhapsody in Blue, or as everybody now calls it, hey, that's the United Airlines theme commercial.
Right, right.
As I said before the break, Mark Carroll wrote an article that says Chicago music critic Howard Reich avoided writing about his family and the Holocaust until it became his calling. And I just want to let you know that I watched the movie Prisoner of Our Past this afternoon.
Yeah.
And I just it was really something. Can you talk about,
thank you.
Obviously you can talk about that. And to be honest with you, I actually found a little bit of humor in it. You want to know where?
Right, that's true.
You want to know where I found it? Can you guess?
Perhaps when I pick up the copy of the themes of the movie, and someone shows me the sheet music, and I say it should be usually an E minor.
Absolutely, that is absolutely the point. The guy plays the theme from The Godfather.
Right.
Or no, your aunt or your cousin played this on a piano in New York, and she's not there.
Yeah.
And he shows you the music, and you go, "Oh, usually that's an E minor, unusual." And
it's a music critic thing. That's how we sing.
I know. It was just like in the midst of all of this, you make that observation just by glancing at that bit of music. I thought it was really something in the midst of everything else that was going on. So please tell those who don't know what this saga is, the story is.
So just briefly, as I mentioned, I'm the son of two Holocaust survivors. And in 2001, my mother was then 69 years old, living in that same Skokie house where I saw An American in Paris. She was living alone. And on the night of February 15, 2001, she packed two shopping bags and ran for her life out of the house around midnight. I was picked up by the Skokie police, who brought her to a relative's house. And the next night, she did that again. And we had to keep her in a safe place. We got her in an assisted living nursing home type situation. And what we eventually realized was my mother was retracing her previously unspoken Holocaust childhood, which she spent also running and hiding, running for her life. But she never told me that story. So I spent a year trying to find out what her story was. And her entire family was massacred. As a child, she was running for her life, and somehow she survived all these executions, came to the United States, and tried to put it behind. But on that night in 2001, her experiences came back at her. And this became a big, I thought this is something to write about. It became a story in the Tribune, a book, and a documentary film that's been seen nationally on PBS and beyond, called Prisoner of Her Past.
She thought someone was going to shoot her in the head.
She said, someone is trying to put a bullet in my head.
A bullet
to this
in my
day,
head.
My mother, who's now 89 years old, believes there's a yellow Star of David on her clothes. Because that's what Jews had to wear then. That means you were marked for death. And at first I would tell her, no, Mom, there's no such thing there. And I realized she would get very upset. And I was denying what she was saying. So I stopped saying that at all, and I just sit and listen.
Well, to get to the story, you literally traveled the world, finding relatives in New York, in the Ukraine, bringing them back to the United States to see if it would positively affect your mother, which I'm not sure it did or didn't. There's just some unbelievable effects of the trauma in her childhood. The story of the bread, the 10 pieces of pumpernickel.
So I will come to the nursing home where my mom is and bring her some bread, because she loves pumpernickel bread. But what she does is this ritual. She divides it in half, 5 slices for her and 5 for me in case I will be hungry later. In other words, she fears that I'm in the same distress that she was as a child, hungry, begging for food. And she wants to make sure that I am not experiencing that. My mother is torn between the present and the past. She can't tell them apart. She doesn't think she's in Poland or Ukraine of 1939, but she believes that all these events are happening again. And she believes everyone is out to kill her, and there's no one who can dissuade her from that.
Man. I know there are many, that this is not an unusual mental condition for people who had a really severe trauma during the Holocaust when they were children.
Right.
And now as adults, this never goes away. And there's a psychiatrist that you talk to in the movie, the documentary, that makes all of this very, very clear as to what's going through your mom's mind. And how did you keep yourself together doing this? Because you seem so, centered in this entire documentary. You seem matter of fact. And the stories that are being told to you about massacres in Ukraine and on, you seem to be able to process it or I don't know, compartmentalize it or what, to maintain an emotional center?
Well, I think off screen it was more difficult. I had nightmares every night throughout that whole process. I had nightmares before I even went to work on this story and to work on the film. But I did have one advantage, which is this was basically a journalistic enterprise, interviewing people, digging, finding facts, finding documents. And that's what I've been doing for a living for 40 some years. So I kind of go into work mode. In fact, I cannot bear to watch any of these Holocaust movies. I don't watch them. They're too difficult for me.
Absolutely.
But if it's a work assignment, if it's for writing, then I go into work mode and I can do it. And that's what I did in the film. I became a professional with as much distance as I could maintain, even though it's my own mother's story.
We don't have enough time to delve into the reaction your mother has to so many things that aren't happening now, but that she believes are. And it looks almost, I'm watching the movie today and I'm like, this is just not unacceptable, but so tragic. But then, towards the end, your sister and her husband and grandchildren come from California. And somehow that in itself seems to brighten your mother's day, for lack of a better term.
Absolutely. In fact, I've often told people, if I just show you the last 5 minutes of this film, you're going to think, oh, what a lovely grandmother with her grandchildren. She has a beautiful life. The grandkids bring out the best in her. And we wanted to end the film on a note of hope, that my mother is not entirely defined by her trauma or her tragedies or the recurrences of her trauma. She's also defined by the great life she led here in the United States, by having children and grandchildren, which this country made possible for her. So we're grateful for that, too, and we wanted to extend that note of hope at the end of the film.
Well, you succeeded in doing that. Tell us what... this has opened up, it seems to be, an entire avenue for you to exercise your journalistic expertise in? And can you tell us what, where we are, where you are currently, and what's going on?
So I'm planning to spend all of my time now writing books and films and doing speaking engagements. And my third next documentary film is coming out later this year. Mm-hmm. It's called For the Left Hand. And I'll just say very briefly what it's about. It's about a Chicagoan named Norman Malone, who grew up on the south side of Chicago in a housing project. And when he was 5 years old, he discovered his love of the piano, became quite proficient. And when he was 10 years old, a tragedy occurred. His father attacked him and his two younger brothers, and then killed himself. The kids survived, but they were all left paralyzed on the right side. But Norman persevered to become a pianist playing music that's written for the left hand. And because of the stories that I wrote that appeared in the Tribune, he launched his concert career at age 78.
Well, you know what? We're going to look. We're out of time, Howard. I'm sorry, but we're going
to. No problem.
We'll talk about it some more in the future for sure. Thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate
it. Pleasure and honor. Thanks for talking to me.
You, anytime.